Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Show Talk with Angela Butler. I'm your host, Angela Butler. We have with us tonight Attorney John Booth from the law firm of Wabarski and Bradley Law Firm. We're going to be talking about President Barack Obama's health care, and we're also going to be talking about Trayvon Martin. Good afternoon.
Hey, how are you?
Mr. Booth. Oh, well, I'm okay. I'm doing fine. And you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Okay. I'm glad you could come on to the show. My first questions would be, what is your opinion on the Trayvon Martin situation?
My overall opinion about it is that everyone is trying to rush to a decision, and that there needs to be an opportunity to gather the facts, what facts can be gathered, and then a jury, if necessary, should make a decision. It seems to be there's a lot of scrutiny given to every piece of evidence that comes in and then a lot of reaction to that evidence. And that's probably not the best way to reach a decision about something as serious as this. So that's my overall opinion about it.
Okay. Do you believe that Mr. George Zimmerman will be brought into a court of law?
I don't know. It's a very interesting problem for the authorities because the actions taken by the Stanford Police Department are consistent with Florida's law, at least as far as I understand the facts. And again, the facts are a little bit confused. But Florida has a stand your ground law. I think that's probably already been discussed on your show before. And under that law, unless the police have reason to believe that Mr. Zimmerman did not act in self-defense, then they really cannot arrest him, at least at that point. Now, that doesn't mean that further investigation cannot and should not be done, and that doesn't mean that evidence may show up that disputes Mr. Zimmerman's story. But as of right now, I think that the law, despite that fact, you have a huge outcry from the community and a demand that Mr. Zimmerman be tried. So it's a real problem for the authorities because on the one hand, the law requires them to do things a certain way, and on the other hand, the community that the law is supposed to protect is demanding something different. And many of these individuals are elected officials, and they're worried about their job. The city police chief in particular seems to be in a quandary because I don't think, at least so far, that there's any legitimate criticism of his actions. And yet the city council voted, I think, 4-5, that they had no confidence in him. And I don't know what more he could have done. But again, we may learn other facts that change my opinion on that.
Okay, we have a caller.
We have
a few callers, but I'm going to go to the first caller. Caller, do you have a question for Attorney Booth, John Booth?
Yes, I have a question. If he's not brought in a criminal court, are there any civil actions that could be brought against him perhaps or that might be brought against him?
Yeah, the answer is yes. Here's the problem. In a criminal case, the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a very high burden. And a state attorney may look at the case and they may say, look, I just don't have enough to convince a jury. The civil arena, the burden of proof is much lower. It's called a preponderance of the evidence or the greater weight of the evidence. If you think of percentages, beyond a reasonable doubt is like 99.9%, whereas a preponderance of the evidence is 51% or 50.01%. So we saw, for example, in the O.J. case, O.J. Simpson was found not guilty by a criminal court and then later on was tried or was brought to a civil suit by the family of Nicole Simpson and was found to be responsible or liable under civil court, even though the facts really weren't much different. And that has to do with the burden of proof. Now, Florida statute 776.012 does provide a level of protection that says if you are in compliance with this statute, this is the stand your ground law, then that is a defense in any civil action. So if the facts are such that it looks like, you know, he followed the letter of the law, it may be a civil action that is ultimately unsuccessful. But a certainly civil action could be brought. And the only thing that can be accomplished through a civil action is wrongful death claim money. So compensation for the loss, to the extent the money could ever do that, but compensation for the loss of a loved one. You could not put him in jail in a civil action. You could not take any sort of punitive actions against him through a civil action. So that's kind of it is a remedy. It's just not a very powerful remedy.
Okay.
Well, how much compensation could they get, if any?
Well, there's no set law in Florida as to the amount of compensation. The compensation is based on the relationship between the family and the son, and that relationship could extend to both financial and just pain and suffering. When you have a child that is lost, usually there's very little financial loss associated with the child's death, but certainly the funeral and other expenses would be covered. If you had a child that was generating income, then the family could make a claim for his estate on that income. And then you have the emotional loss, and that is obviously, there is no money that makes that right, but they can make a claim and the jury could award as much or as little as they think is appropriate. If he was very close to his family, and it seems like he was, then the jury would be more likely to award more money. If he had an estranged family where he was not very close with either parent, then theoretically the jury could award less. But that's left completely within the discretion of the jury.
Can punitive damages be awarded for this type of conduct?
Punitive damages can be awarded. They're very rare in civil cases. And what you have to show is willful and wanton misconduct. And it really, depending on what the facts are in the case, those could be awarded. But, again, there's no set amount. But Florida has a percentage ratio where the punitive damages can never be are based in part on the compensatory damages. So if the jury awards, and I'm just going to pick numbers that are simple for my purposes, if the jury awards $100 for compensatory damages, they could not award $1 million for punitive damages. The punitive damages has to be within a certain ratio of the compensatory damages. And for punitive damages, they also look at the financial wealth or lack of wealth of Mr. Zimmerman. For compensatory damages, we never look at that. But if Mr. Zimmerman is someone that is living paycheck to paycheck, then the jury would be instructed they cannot bankrupt the man for punitive damages. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes,
okay.
Of course.
All right. Any other
questions? I have a question. The host has a question. The fact that Mr. Zimmerman had been said that he's had run-ins before, that can't be brought up in court, can it?
It depends on a couple of things. If he does not testify, then it's almost impossible to bring that in. There are exceptions to that, but almost impossible. If he does testify, then felony convictions could be brought in. Convictions which are not necessarily felonies but involve dishonesty and false statement could be brought in. I'm not saying he has any of these. I'm just saying these are examples. The only other scenario that I could see it comes in is if Mr. Martin was not the first victim of Mr. Zimmerman, and there is a pattern here where he selects people and does things to them, then the police or the state attorney could bring in evidence of those other cases to show that this was not a mistake or this was not an example of self-defense. This is an example of someone who's a predator. So those are kind of the three exceptions. And it is unlikely. I think he has two lawyers working for him. It is unlikely that Mr. Zimmerman would testify if he's going to get a lot of backlash from past history. His lawyers would try to shelter him from that.
Okay.
And let me just add something else to your question, because there's a flip side to that question. If Mr. Martin has a history of violence, and again, I'm not saying he does, but if he does, the defense might be able to bring that in to show that Mr. Martin may have acted in conformity with that history of violence. And that is another issue that is a concern for the state attorney's office, although, again, I haven't heard any evidence to suggest that Mr. Martin did have a history of violence. But
okay.
if you know that someone is a dangerous individual by reputation, then that's a factor that you would be considering if you were confronting that individual in a potentially hostile situation. So the defense would be allowed to bring that in.
Okay. All right. The fact that he was 17 years old, not yet 18, would that play in any way in the justice system's decision to arrest him or not to arrest him, to charge him or not to charge him?
Well, I think the fact that that Mr. Martin was 17 years old has played a role in the pressure that is being put on the authorities to make an arrest. He's viewed as a child. He's viewed as an innocent. But I don't think it, from a purely legal standpoint, I don't think it should make a difference to law enforcement's decision or the state attorney's decision to bring the charges. The other issue is we look at his physical capability. I mean, certainly if this was a 9-year-old child who supposedly attacked Mr. Zimmer, that no one would believe him. But Mr. Martin is 17 years old. I think I've heard descriptions of him as being over 6 feet tall and very athletic. So it is not out of the question that someone of that size could pose a threat to someone. Now, whether he did or not, I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying that doesn't change. I mean, that suggests that Mr. Zimmerman's story at least doesn't initially get rejected as it would if it was a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old or someone who physically could not pose a threat. But the law theoretically treats individuals the same regardless of a variety of categories, such as age or sex or race. We all know that doesn't always happen. But theoretically, the law should be applied the same.
In your opinion, was this a hate crime? You don't know?
I haven't seen any evidence that suggests that to me. The thing that keeps sticking in my mind as I listen to the facts is that Mr. Zimmerman, I think, made a phone call before the encounter occurred. After the shooting, Mr. Zimmerman yelled for witnesses to call 911, and he stayed there. Now, I know there's some arguments about what he did or didn't do while he was there and whether he did or did not render first aid, and I'm not arguing that one way or the other. But it seems unusual that someone who went out to commit a hate crime would both notify the police of what's going on ahead of time and then, second of all, hang around for the police afterwards. So I'm not saying it isn't, but it's unusual. I would have expected if Mr. Zimmerman was engaging in hate crime that he would have done it much more under the radar, that he would have maybe committed the crime and never notified anyone he was there. And also, why would he choose to commit a hate crime in his own neighborhood? Why not,
okay.
Especially a populated neighborhood? So I don't know, but that's my thoughts on it.
Okay. In your opinion, should the Stand Your Ground law be revised, and do you know if anybody is looking into the Stand Your Ground law?
Well, the Stand Your Ground law was passed in Florida in 2004. There's actually 10 other states that have similar provisions. North Carolina, Texas, Illinois, Kentucky, there's a few others, but those are examples. The Stand Your Ground law was actually passed because of Florida's duty to retreat statute that was causing a lot of problems. The duty to retreat statute basically said you have to run away from a violent confrontation unless you cannot, or by running away you actually increase your danger. So if I've got you backed up against a crowded street and you can't run away because you'll be running into traffic, then you don't have to run away. The problem with that is it led to justifiable people who are justifiably engaged in self-defense being prosecuted and spending tens of thousands of dollars to defend themselves. And I actually was involved in one of those cases. I was a lawyer involved in a case with a business owner who was forced to shoot a felon, and the felon said to him, you know, I'm going to kill you, and charged at him. And the felon was a big guy, clearly capable of carrying out the threat. He had a history of violence. And the defendant, the man who ultimately stood trial, had done everything he properly could to avoid the confrontation. But ultimately, he shot the man, and The evidence was my client did not retreat. And the reason he did not retreat is he physically could not have retreated. Didn't change the fact that he got prosecuted. Didn't change the fact that he spent, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. The jury was out 15 minutes. 15 minutes is long enough to go back in the room, go to the bathroom, vote for a foreman, take one vote, and come out. So 6 to 7 months worth of stress, a lot of legal fees, a lot of sleepless nights. The jury's in and out 15 minutes. And he's not the only situation. So we had a reaction to these types of problems where individuals who were justified in what their actions were being prosecuted unfairly. And no one reimburses those individuals for their money. No one reimburses them for all that they go through. So they created a stand your ground law. An argument could be made that they went too far. I don't know. But this law was passed with huge popular support in 2004. And since its passing, this is one of the first times that it has come up as an issue. And here's the other thing to think about. If Mr. Zimmerman was out there to commit a crime, then what the status of the law doesn't matter to him.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. But the thing that makes it so tragic to so many people was that the child, the young man, the teenager, only had some candy and a soda. You know, so that's what made he was unarmed.
Yeah.
He was completely unarmed.
And
that's what makes it so tragic.
And in the case
and
I
the
just
other man
about,
had a gun, and he was an adult.
Here's the problem, and it's one of these situations where unless you've actually been through one, it's hard to explain. But the individual I told you about before, the business owner who shot the felon was completely unarmed. He had absolutely no weapon. And that was the argument that was being raised against my client was you shot an unarmed man. And the thought being that an unarmed man is not a threat. That's not true. An unarmed man can be a threat, and an unarmed man certainly can do a lot of damage to you and can kill you if given enough time and opportunity. So the other thing is, and there's been some talk about what clothing was worn and all those other things. The problem is, in a self-defense situation, it happens very quickly. And it happens at such a speed that you don't have time to register all the details. So when someone is wearing, let's say, a hoodie, you may not be able to see their face. If it's dark, you may not be able to see their expressions or what they're doing. If their hands are inside their pockets, you don't know what their hands are on. So even in a legitimate self-defense situation, you can have a shooting of an unarmed person. And from a legal standpoint, that shooting may be considered justified. I'll give you a real quick example. We had another case where we had a young lady was shot her husband coming in through the bedroom window. She loved her husband. There was no issue about infidelity or anything like that. He simply came home early one night. He was supposed to be on a trip. He came home early. She had a gun for self-defense. He wanted to surprise her, so he came in through the bedroom window because I don't know if he didn't have his keys or what his reason was. She thought it was a burglar. She gets woken up in the middle of the night. She pulls out a gun. There's a strange figure clawing in her bedroom window. She assumes the worst. She shoots and kills him. Horrible tragedy. But no one thought that she intended to do it.
Okay.
And that's just what can happen sometimes. I think
the
police advice to Mr. Zimmerman seemed to be correct, and it's a shame that it wasn't followed, or at least from what I understand it wasn't followed. Do not confront him. Go back to the car. We're going to send out the police. They'll deal with it.
That's another thing. He was told not to follow him and not to confront him.
Right. But here's the other thing on Zimmerman's
side. He kind of took the law into his own hands in a way.
Well, he did. But here's the other thing on Zimmerman's side, if you want to flip it around. Those instructions by the police were recommendations. They're not instructions. Mr. Zimmerman was in a place where he had a right to be. As far as we know, he was not engaged in lawful activity. So he's free to follow the police's recommendations or not. Now he has to accept the consequences for what he did. But in that scenario, what the police told him were not commands that had to be followed as a matter of law. They were simply recommendations.
Okay.
So that's an issue.
Okay, listeners, we have with us tonight Attorney John Boo from the law firm Wabarski & Bradley. We're going to go to break, and we're going to come back and talk about President Barack Obama's health care bill and how it's affecting how it will affect automobile policies. All right, let's go to break and pay some bills.
When you're searching for the latest news on entertainment, the economy, business, technology, and creative arts, choose
the Digital Conglomerate Magazine.
Not only do they give you all the latest information, but they're there for you 24/7, baby, giving you the 411 and all you need to know, baby. Visit the Digital Conglomerate Magazine online. Just Google us, baby. We're everywhere. Let's get down to business. So you're having that company function or business function, and you need the proper services to get that business menu pumped. Okay, here's the solution. Call Exquisite Barista Services. Exquisite Barista Services has the experience to create a signature beverage for your business or organization. Services also include barista training, custom beverage menu creation, food and beverage pairing, and so much more. Visit Exquisite Barista Services online at www.exquisiteexpressinc.com or better yet, call 210-701-0143. That's 210-701-0143. Don't take your chances on the other man. Get that grand plan and choose Exquisite Barista Services.
All right, listeners, let's not forget Demetrius Stewart, online magazine, AtlantaAmbition.com. Let's not forget that magazine dedicated to her. And also, let's not forget Conti Cantina, the inventor of More Time to Sleep, the baby sleeping system for fussy babies. Let's not forget him. And to buy his product, and to go to the www.moretimetosleep website, that's mtts.com, .org. Let's not forget Jawana Ramsey and his film Lost It All, which will be at film festivals. I hope to see that in the theater one day. And let's not forget Abby Merriweather and her husband, who is selling Visalis. You can hit them up on Facebook. All right, let's go into some music.
Yeah, fortune theory, survivor of all turbulence. You know what it is? It's my game, survivor. Come on.
Yeah. I'm a survivor, I look everywhere, all I see is fire. Shouting up louder, all I'm desire, oh Lord. I'm a survivor, hey. I'm a survivor, I look everywhere, all I see is fire. Shouting up louder, all I'm desire, oh Lord. I'm a survivor,
hey. My word is brand new, I bring it to you just as new. 1, 2, 3, buckle up my shoes. You can listen to the news, the words that I offer. I testimonies to good better times in the past. I tap my back through the wall and praises to God. I break the four walls, I broke on the back of the terrible beast.
All right, listen, that's X40, the rapper from West Africa, with the song Survival. You can find him at www.reverbnation.com. All right, we're here with Attorney John Booth from the law firm Wabarski & Bradley. We're now going to talk about President Barack Obama's health care plan that is now in the Supreme Court. Mr. Booth.
Yes.
Now, President Barack Obama's health care plan, how do you feel it will affect automobile policies? A personal injury.
I'm not sure exactly how that's all going to shake out because each state has their own automobile policies. So you have 50 different laws effectively in place. Florida has, which is where I live, Florida has recently made a change to their car insurance policy, which makes it more difficult for individuals who are involved in car accidents to get health care. And so that means that they're going to be more reliant than ever on health care from other sources, such as what their boss provides or what they can get through individual health insurance. If the Affordable Care Act is in any way shot down, that may put those individuals kind of in a catch-22 situation where their car insurance does not help them get needed trauma care and their health insurance either doesn't exist or doesn't provide them with the care they need. If Obamacare stays in place, at least as I understand the law, and it's 2,700 pages long, it's got 10 different subsections, but at least as I understand it, it is more likely that it would be helpful to individuals who are injured in car accidents and who need treatment. And of course, it would also be beneficial to other scenarios too, whether it's well-person visits or follow-up for treatment of disease or other types of injuries.
Okay.
But,
go on.
Well, I was going to say that what we have in Florida is we have a governor that was elected. He's got a very strong Tea Party connection. And he came in, and this change in Florida's law was one of the things he ran upon. He wanted to. He argued that I don't know. It was wrong that people should be able to go to the hospital whenever they needed to go to the hospital, or something along those lines. So we do have a definite backlash against Obamacare that is spilling over into the states, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that's a good thing for individuals who actually need help. I mean,
yes,
if you're perfectly healthy, you don't need either health insurance or car insurance. But if you've been injured or you have an illness or anything along those lines, you need as much insurance as you can afford.
All right. Okay. I agree. So will it affect workers' compensation any? You don't know.
Workers' compensation, probably not as much. Yeah, workers'
okay.
compensation is a different system, so probably not. But
okay.
Medicare, it will affect Medicare. In fact, Medicaid. One of the things about Obamacare that has not been discussed very much is that it is going to be a large increase. It's the largest expansion of Medicaid since Medicaid was first established. They're doing it a couple of different ways. It used to be that if you made $24,000 or less as a family, you would qualify for Medicaid. Under Obamacare, that is expanded. If you make $31,000 or less as a family, you qualify for Medicaid. So a lot more people will qualify for government care. Now, we can argue about whether that's better or worse, but I generally fall into the position that having some degree of health insurance is a better thing than having no health insurance. If you have no health insurance, you're much more limited in your ability to get any kind of care and treatment. So,
okay, go on.
Well, I was going to say the last estimate is that about under Obamacare, 17 million more people will be covered by Medicaid than are currently covered. So that's just something else to think about.
Okay, I have one more question. I have a statement, more or less. I feel that if people have health insurance, they can go to the doctor and get treatment and get health care and things like that. And preventive health care, to me, makes more sense than letting people work until they get sick, too sick to work.
Oh, you're exactly right. And that's the problem. Most doctors will tell you that preventative care, you know, the old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of care. It's true. Most doctors will say if we can see people on a regular basis, it will increase the odds that we'll find problems sooner than later, and problems that are found sooner than later, they have a better chance of a positive outcome. So then you're 100% right. And the problem with the individual mandate, which is currently what the Supreme Court is arguing about, is healthy people don't want to spend the money on health insurance, which makes sense. I mean, they're in an age group and a time in their lives when that does not seem like a necessary expense. But if they don't, then the people who do need health insurance, they'll be the sole insured population, and the insurance companies can't afford to only insure sick people. The insurance companies will go into financial problems. So there does need to be a balancing. And the other thing that is important is what we call insurance. I mean, I have Blue Cross Blue Shield, and I have a $3,000 family deductible. I couldn't get a better deductible than that. So $3,000 a year is what I have to spend, in addition to my premiums. $3,000 a year is what I have to spend before I get dime one of my health insurance. So, you know, even if I get health insurance through Obamacare or other sources, I'm still coming out of my pocket for most of that care. But what my health insurance does for me and my family is it allows me to get in to see a doctor. It is surprisingly difficult to get in to see a doctor if you don't have insurance.
Yes, it is.
And I know this because I work with a lot of injured individuals, and I try to help them get appointments. And doctors will say, no insurance, we want cash up front. And the cash up front is, you know, $500, $750. I don't have to deal with that, even though ultimately I'm going to be paying that bill because I have health insurance.
Okay.
And that's unfair. That's very unfair. I think that everyone should have the ability to get the care that they need when they need it.
Yes, sir. I agree with that. I agree with everything you just said about the health care under President Barack Obama, pretty much everything anyway. All right, listeners, I see I have a lot of callers. I didn't go and I asked you all if you had questions because it's only a 30-minute show tonight. But I'd like for Attorney John Booth to say which firm he's from and what kind of work they do, if he'd like to.
That's fine. I'm with Laborski & Bradley, and we primarily do civil trial work, personal injury type cases, car accidents, medical malpractice, slip and falls. That's the type of cases we mostly handle.
Okay. All right. All right, listeners. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Boop.
You're welcome.
All right, listeners. That's you too. Have a good night. All right, listeners, that was Mr. Attorney John Booth from Wabarski & Bradley Law Firm. You've been listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. We're going to end the show now, and I thank you all for calling in and listening. I didn't have time to go to the chat questions, but maybe Monday I'll be able to do that. Thank you all for calling in, and feel free to call in again for those of you who don't have internet access. Thank you for calling in and listening to the show. Have a good night, everyone.